The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 9:05, Wednesday, the 23rd of August, 2023. How are you all keeping? I do hope you are the best you can be. And we're very pleased to have you on board for the show for the next 3 hours and, of course, across the day here on Highland Radio. We are kind of unique in that we have the best listeners, I would argue, in Europe. Certainly we can prove in Ireland in that you switch on in the morning and you stay with us. And it's so much appreciated and so welcomed, and we acknowledge it and realise the importance of it. So thank you so much for your loyalty and sticking with us. Okay, we're going to keep you informed and entertained over the next 3 hours, bringing you stories behind the headlines, making the headlines. How do we do so? With your assistance. WhatsApp and text 086 6025000, 086 6025000, or give us a call on 07491 25000, 07491 25000. Your emails from anywhere, comments at highlandradio.com. And just to remind you, if you're listening from outside the Republic, we want you involved in the show as well with the text, WhatsApp number and the phone number. It's 00353, and then you drop the first O and away you go there. I just wish that we could have international numbers instead of these convoluted international dialing numbers in this day and age, but we are where we are. Okay, let's have a look at the papers. The Finn Valley Voice. Is this a part of the programme that you enjoy when we go through some of the headlines on the papers too? Always good to get your feedback, by the way. But anyway, you can do so on 086 6025000. The Finn Valley Voice this morning. A Ballybuffet mother of two disabled young adults are wheelchair users who want a wheelchair user, I beg your pardon, has appealed to Donegal County Council to drop a curb at the left-hand entrance to Blue Cedars. Siobhan Lund, a dentist, lives at Capri on the same side of the road as Blue Cedars with her husband Ian, an orthodontist, son Rory, who uses a power wheelchair, and daughter Kira. The family often walk into town on the footpath that has dropped curbs except for the left-hand entrance at Blue Cedars, forcing the family onto the main road. Full details on that story and that family's appeal in today's Finn Valley Voice. On to the Inishowen Independent. Business owners in Buncrana have slammed a proposal by Donegal County Council to abolish the half hour of free parking offered in the town. Visitors can park their vehicle for free for up to 30 minutes before having to purchase a parking ticket. But Donegal County Council is looking to abolish the grace period, which business people say will be detrimental to trade in the town. More than 100 businesses canvassed by Paul Brogan have signed a petition opposing the plan. Any change for the parking is going to be a disaster for businesses, particularly on the main street. Union McLaughlin from Max Bookshop said, adding that many businesses in the town are just hanging on amidst the cost of living crisis. They don't need anything that's going to make trading more difficult. And again, when we discussed this last week on the show, the one thing I mused was if you get rid of on-street parking, the grace period, does that actually mean there's going to be free parking spaces available? I doubt it. So there's more revenue for the council, but arguably no advantage for the businesses. The Inish Times, the father of 17-year-old wheelchair user is hit out at the lack of suitable public changing spaces for people with disabilities in Donegal, which is just one such registered public toilet. Changing places facilities are public toilets which are fitted with specialist equipment, including a hoist and changing bench. They provide enough space for up to two carers to support the person with a disability to use the changing place. Aaron Daly, who you heard on this show at the start of the week and who lives in Dublin but is a regular visitor to family in Inishowen, says there are no publicly available facilities in the peninsula, and on day trips the family were forced to bring a mattress so they can change their daughter Sophia in the back of their van. And then as a follow-up to the story, we heard that there could be the provision of two such facilities in Letterkenny, but that doesn't address the issue in Inishowen, and it's one certainly we'll continue to platform and highlight here so that we live in a, as much as possible, fully inclusive society. Donegal Post this morning. Sleaf League Distilliers has announced the historic release of the first legally distilled whisky from Donegal since 1840. And three of the earliest bottles in the run have already been auctioned for charity, with two going to support the people of Creasler at the Dublin Business, the Dublin Donegal Business Association Person of the Year evening, and one to the child loss charity Rosabelle's Rooms in Galway. Sleeve League Single Malt Irish Whiskey, the Kilcar release, marks a significant milestone in Donegal distilling history, rekindling an age-old craft and sharing the true spirit of Donegal with the world. And the couple behind that, we were sitting with them actually at the Dublin Donegal Business Association Person of the Year competition a couple of months ago. Lovely people, and we wish them nothing but success there. Right, we've been talking about electricity prices all week, and I was thinking when I was driving home yesterday evening of the lady towards the end of the show, and some of you tune in and tune out as it suits your lifestyle and what else you might be doing. She is caring for her uncle, and her bill is around about 200. I'm going to round it up just for simplicity. Her bill's around 200 euro, and has been for the last couple of bills. And her last bill, 600 euro. And simply the question was, how was she going to pay it, dreading heading into winter? Now, just to be clear, and I'm sure it's going to be mentioned in this article, wholesale electricity prices fluctuate, okay? That's what you'll hear from electricity companies. But they are 64% lower than they had been at their peak. So they're saving an awful lot of money. Now, if they're bad at hedging and buy too much expensive electricity, should we really have to pick up the tab because of their bad business decision? I don't think so. But we are paying the second highest rate for electricity. Now, that might actually be, I'll double check that. I'm mixing up some stats here. The price of electricity wholesale, where the companies buy, is definitely down 64%. We are pay some of the highest electricity, but it's the second highest in terms of what we pay in terms of VAT and what have you on booze. And I'm mixing those two things up because we're going to be talking about those issues today. But anyway, households in this country, the Republic, are paying almost €1,000 more every year for their electricity compared to their European partners, their average, the European average. New figures indicate electricity prices here are the highest in Europe, 900 a year more compared with the EU average. So that's the EU average. So that means there are some paying much less than the EU average, others paying more. Why are we paying out of our pockets? We're a rich country, allegedly, paying 900 a year more. So that lady we spoke to at the end of the show yesterday, who doesn't know how she's going to pay a winter bill when a summer bill is 600 euro, why, who is making the decision that it's okay for her and the thousands like her in Donegal? Why is that okay? It's not okay. Bills here are 80% higher than the European Union average, according to the Household Energy Price Index. The index is commissioned by the Australian Energy Regulator and the Hungarian Energy Regulator. It compares the price of energy in the capital cities of 32 European countries and Britain, which is not in the EU, of course. Its latest survey shows electricity prices here are the highest of the 32 capitals surveyed. Dublin and London are the most expensive cities for household customers in Europe, followed by Prague, Riga and Berlin, a press release issued with the index said. So, as I say, why are we paying so much here? Who is asleep at the wheel that is not making sure that electricity companies don't gouge us? How are they all charging prices that are too high? You know what? I'm not saying there's a monopoly or anything along those lines, but why does it so happen that all electricity supply, and I wouldn't mind, but at times, and we know the reasons why, at times, up to 50% of our electricity is generated by wind in this country. Quite consistently, it's around about 37% in any given day. There was at one point, and there does come points, where it's actually, it costs nothing to produce that wind energy, but we don't get any benefits from that. Why is that allowed to happen? Who is responsible? Who's asleep at the wheel? Who's not doing their job? We don't need ministers or government leaders or even opposition, but opposition, it's a different for them because they don't have decisions to make, to say it's unbelievable. It shouldn't be happening. Electricity companies shouldn't be we need them to introduce measures to ensure that electricity companies aren't gouging Irish people simply because we live on this island. On to the Irish Times now, and the national body for the triathlon and the organisers of the Ironman event in which two swimmers died have clashed over the circumstances in which the Cork race started. As the opposition pressed for an independent inquiry into the deaths, sharp divisions emerged between Triathlon Ireland and the US-owned Ironman Group over the status of the race, which began in rough seas at Yeovil on Sunday. And before I read on, I mean, obviously there's a bit to and fro, but I heard a Galway TVD on the radio who spoke perfectly as far as I was concerned on this issue. And he was asked, you know, should there be an independent inquiry? What should be done? This, that and the other. And it was the most sensible commentary I've heard from someone in an awful long time. He said, let's just wait. He says, let's wait until such time as the coroner makes a determination on the cause of death of these two gentlemen who very sadly lost their lives. And I thought, wow, that just, it's common sense, of course, because he says, yes, of course, we have this situation whereby there are some that believe this race shouldn't have gone ahead and people are arguing as to whether or not they sanctioned it or not. And of course, then we have this terrible loss of life, but we don't know the correlation between the two. And really, until those facts are established, the conversation really is a bit previous. I thought he spoke really well and I thought that made an awful lot of sense. And I think he might be on the show later, we shall see. But anyway, athletes have complained of horrendous conditions during the sea swim part of the event, in which Ivan Chittenden, who's 64, and Brendan Wall, 45, died. But people travelled from great distances from all over the world and locally. And of course, there was always the choice whether or not to get involved. The Irish Daily Mail this morning, motorists will soon be unable to pay for their cars NCT in cash, a decision which has sparked furious criticism nationwide. The National Car Test, which all cars over 4 years old must pass, is to introduce the new rules soon in a bid to cut down on the number of appointment no-shows at its testing centres. Motorists will have to pay up front when booking a test, either by card, bank transfer or postal order. The NCT said it is bringing in the prepayment rule in an effort to slash the 2,500 no-shows and 1,000 late cancellations a week. But the move has been condemned, particularly by charities for the elderly, who say many older people prefer cash and are not computer literate and do not have credit or debit cards. It's prompted fears that older people could be subjected to higher levels of financial abuse by a growing ban on cash across society. And I think the views of our listeners are almost unanimous in that we don't, when I say we, I mean the listeners, don't want this rapid progress towards a cashless society. Pubs are under pressure. Nearly 2,000 pubs have closed in the last 18 years, with 108 boozers shutting their doors in 2022 alone, a report shows. This is The Sun. The Drinks Industry Group of Ireland, which has published a study which shows that 1,937 establishments across the country have shut since 2005. This represents a 22.5% decline, and the rate of closure is speeding up, according to the group. Now, locally here in Donegal, compared to 2005, we have a quarter less pubs now. 26.3% of pubs that were open in 2005 are now closed. It's not the highest figures in other counties such as Limerick, Roscommon and Cork. They're in and around the 30%, but we're not too far behind them. 26.3% of pubs that were open in 2005 in Donegal are now closed. And as I said, and I confused some of my statistics, there are some calls, and I can't see it happening, for a reduction in excise and what have you on booze. It's the second highest rate in Europe. Ireland has the second highest rate of VAT and charges and what have you. Now, we were talking yesterday about crime in Donegal. 16 assaults in the last 6 days, really quite significant. And we appreciate Gardenal Maguire's stats on that. But obviously there's a great deal of concern as to what's going on in Dublin. Now, we did hear from a group that works with tourists. They say they've seen a slight increase in the amount of tourists that need assistance, around 790, I believe it was, so far this year. 9 out of 10 of those tourists go on to hopefully enjoy their holiday, but continue it in any case. And there's an awful lot of conversation about what's happening in Dublin. So what would be an appropriate response? Well, they've decided to put Garda riot squads on the streets of Dublin, armed Gardaí on the streets of Dublin. Now, what do you think about that? Do you think that's a bit of an overstep? to deal with the type of criminality that's ongoing down there. But anyway, the Garda riot squad, backed up by armed police units, is to be deployed onto the streets of Dublin to tackle the scourge of violent crime blighting the city. In a major announcement yesterday, Garda chiefs revealed they will use €2 million worth of government funding to fully deploy the National Public Order Unit to tackle the capital's crime problem. A new Garda policing plan will also see armed units increasing their vehicle patrols around Dublin, though they will not walk the streets. The significant development comes after a recent spate of high-profile incidents of crime in the capital. And they're high-profile because the papers and the radio stations have made them high-profile. This includes a horrific attack on an American tourist in Talbot Street and an incident in the heart of Temple Bar. But it does seem a little bit draconian, does it not? What do you think? 086 60 25,000. Maybe a more proportionate response spread across the country to make everyone feel safe wherever they are. And finally, congratulations to New York woman Roisin Wiley. She is the new International Rose of Tralee. She admitted to being speechless as she was crowned last night. The 27-year-old who lives and works in Manhattan and whose parents hail from Limerick was the red-hot favourite to win the year this year's concert contest. Yet a stunned Roisin told co-hosts Dahi O'Shea and Catherine Thomas that she was overwhelmed when her name was read out. Last year's Rose Westmeath woman Rachel Duffy placed the sash on Roisin as she admitted to being emotional at handing over her crown. And lots of you tuned into it. 500,000 viewers tuned in for the first night live. And I'm sure many of you again did last night. If you've any views on that, again, 086 60 25,000. It is the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. Tracy McGuinness is ATU Masters of Research student and physiotherapist in Killybegs Hospital and joins us now. How are you getting on, Tracy? Great to see you.
Good to see you too. Yeah, I'm getting on fine. Thank you.
Good stuff. Right. Now, you're working on really quite an important project, and I think it's important in that lots of people have different views on how we dealt with the pandemic, and there's nothing to suggest that we might not have to deal with future events into the future. So we have to learn what we did right, and I suppose what we did wrong. Now, you're working on a new project that focuses on an aspect of this. Can you outline it for us?
Yeah, so our project focuses on understanding the effects of the hospital visiting restrictions on the family members of older adults during the COVID-19 pandemic, because as we're all aware, the restrictions have been there to ensure patient safety, but they also led to significant emotional and psychological challenges for families who are unable to visit their loved ones during these times. So our goal is really to uncover the emotional impact and gain insight on how the families cope with the absence of the physical presence there. So we would love and we'd be humbled to hear families' stories, struggles, and strategies that they developed to stay connected with their family members during that time.
And will this, or do you attempt to balance this with the reasons as to why these restrictions were put in place? In other words, that we can sort of say, right, this was a public health measure to protect people, but then you might be able to establish the impact it had on people and you know, will you weigh those up, or is that part of this study?
Well, the main part of this study is just to explore the experience of family members in the northwest of Ireland and ascertain how it affected them. And really, we would love to provide recommendations to healthcare going forward for innovative ideas to stay connected. I think the HSC made great steps in their digital transformation during this time. What they achieved in 3 months would have taken 5 years normally to stay connected with people. So just getting people's stories, did it work well for them? Did it not work well for them? Like, there's no right or wrong answers. It's just, we just want to hear people's stories at this stage.
It's difficult for me to interview on this because I know you'd be very conscious of not trying to skew it one way or the other, Tracy. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So that you end up sort of maybe, so you want it to be fully representative, don't you?
Yes, I want to hear everybody's stories, as I say, the good, the bad and the ugly, and just get those stories conveyed. Really what motivated me as to do this project as a physiotherapist, I feel family play a vital role in the healing process of a patient, and especially a family member, because they provide both emotional and physical support, motivation and, you know, a sense of belonging, which helps in the healing process. So research has widely shown the importance of family in the healing progress of a of the patient.
And that's in the hospital environment, you mean?
Yes, in the hospital and at home as well.
Yeah, but
in the hospital
but for the
as well.
Purpose of this, so the importance of visiting people. Now, I think, you know, you will get all different types of stories, but I mean, I know from working on this program, Tracy, it was very, very difficult for people because there was the sense that, A, they couldn't see their loved one, especially, you know, if there was if they thought it might be an end-of-life situation, but then felt guilty concerning themselves with the emotional impact this was having, the person who probably felt isolated in the hospital. It was an absolute, and you could say the same in other healthcare settings, it was an absolute nightmare for people.
Yeah, it was a very upsetting time, and people really had to change their way of communicating, of staying in touch with people. You know, I've heard stories, you know, a friend of mine tells me a story of her father had COVID-19 and, you know, the whole hassle of getting him and the stress and anxiety of getting him to the hospital. And then all of a sudden she left him at the hospital, the doors closed, and that was it for 3 weeks. You know, she didn't hear or see or touch or stay in contact with that. And I think it's really important that we portray those stories and, you know, learn from them what we can do better or what was done good.
Yeah, because... Again, not wishing to sort of preempt the type of input you might have from people, but I think the majority of people would want us to look at this, understanding that maybe you have to do things to protect people, but you have to look at what the consequences of those actions are.
Yeah, this is true, yeah. And just see, is there better ways of getting around it or strategies for helping people to cope? Maybe people develop strategies, and even if you could convey those to people as well going forward.
Now, are you focusing on people that were in hospital receiving treatment, or are you also interested in hearing from couples perhaps who, you know, one partner was pretty much excluded from the hospital during pregnancy, for an example, or is it specific to someone who's being treated in hospital?
No, it's specific to, I suppose, older adults, patients that were over 65 years of age, because it's such a vast amount of patients that were in hospital at the time. We just focused on the over 65s because a lot of research was done on patients in nursing homes. So being in an acute hospital setting is a little bit different because the family members aren't familiar with the staff. So it was another challenge for them as well. So we're really focusing on older adults that were in acute hospital during the COVID-19 pandemic.
And just more generally, just I thought it really interesting your comments about how, you know, having access to visitors helps people recover. How does that happen? Is that the psychological impact of it? Is it because it gives them more hope, or you know, even separate to the pandemic, why do you think that is such a benefit to the patients?
I think it's a benefit to patient because a motivation, hope, and as well they can act as an advocate for the patient. So if they need to communicate to the healthcare professionals, because sometimes people are just too ill to communicate, the family member can represent, the family member can tell you a little bit more that you mightn't get from the patient as well, from a healthcare professional view as well. So yeah, they're very good advocates.
Right, so how do people get involved in it, Tracy?
Yeah, so we have a Facebook page. It's called Visiting Restricts Res. We also have an email address called visitingrestrictionsresearch@atu.ie. It's quite a mouthful there. And we have a mobile number as well. So if people have pen and paper ready, it's 089-404-5251.
And we'll retain all of that information here because people, I think, know our number and stuff off by heart, and we're more than happy to pass it on. And do you hope to interview people, Tracy? Is that how you're going to gather the information?
Yeah, we're very flexible with interviews. We can do them online, we can do them over the phone, or we can do them face to face. And like that, I just want to emphasize there's no right or wrong answers. There's no specific stories we're looking for. We just want to hear your story.
And it's okay if you think it was the right thing to do and you were happy with all the outcomes. That's fine too. You want to hear
all the sides of the story. And it'd be a great learning curve for everyone to hear all the sides of the story.
It's a big piece of work when obviously you've got to go through the interviews and then collating it and presenting it. When do you hope to have the findings of this project available?
We hope to have the findings for next September. So we hope as well to present them at conferences, you know, nationally and maybe internationally as well. We've worked closely with a project that was done in Portugal under the same topic, and they had a lot of interesting findings from there. So we're just kind of going on from their research as well. So
Yeah, and if you decided how you're going to present it, is it going to be sort of, and I think those reports are very impactful, where you do have quotes from people and it's sort of really,
yes,
you know, such and such a person and this was an experience. It really brings home the reality of what people went through.
Yeah, I just want to emphasise as well that everything's anonymous during the interviews. Names aren't recorded or anything like that. But we hope to get our research published and get our findings given out in that way. And
all right.
Of course, we'll come back in Highland Radio and tell you the results as
please
well.
Please do. Please do. Thank you very much for that. As I say, we'll retain all the information here, the contact information. But what effectively is, we're speaking to Tracy McGuinness. She's an ATU Masters of Research student and physiotherapist in Killybegs Hospital and is working on a project focusing on understanding the effects of hospital visiting restrictions on family members of older adults over 65s during the pandemic. And I will ask you just to go through the contact details one more time in case people are keenly waiting with a pen. But as I say, we'll retain them. So if someone says, right, I've an experience I want to share, what do they do next, Tracy?
I think the simplest thing is just give me a buzz on 089-404-5251.
Okay.
And we also have an email address, which is visitingrestrictionsresearch@atu.ie. And we're on Facebook as well.
visitingrestrictionsresearch@atu.ie. Thank you for your time.
Yes.
And as I say, I look forward to chatting to you again once that piece of work is ready to be made public. Thank you so much. That is Tracy McGuinness, ATU Masters of Research student. Okay. 086 60 25 000. Received an email this morning. Maybe you can help this listener with this dilemma that they are in. Now, we were going to wait and put it to Keely as part of Ask Greg, as Caroline calls it, but I thought I'd give it a mention now just to see if you've got a view on it. And maybe it is just reflective of a number of things, modern society and different ways of making an income, and B, I suppose the cost of living that makes us think about different ways of doing that. But I'll read on anyway. Dear Greg and listeners, I'm writing to seek your advice on a rather personal matter that's been weighing on my mind the last while. I'm a young mother who lives in a rural area of Donegal, and I have been considering the idea of joining OnlyFans. Now, for those who are not aware, OnlyFans is a platform whereby, for the most part, you people sign up and they publish pictures of themselves, often in a state of semi-undress or undress. And people subscribe, and a lot of people make quite a lot of money from it. So this young mother, who's from a rural part of Donegal, is considering signing up to OnlyFans. They go on to say, while the prospect of financial independence is appealing, of course, I do have some concerns. Firstly, I worry about being recognised within my tight-knit community and what might come from that. I live in a small town and word tends to spread really quickly. I fear the judgment and scrutiny that may come my way and in the way of my family, or by the way of my family. I want my privacy, of course, but I also want the freedom to express myself on such a platform. As a mother, I want to set a positive example for my child, but I also want to make choices that empower me and helps me to pay the mounting bills that everyone's facing at the moment. I'm reaching out to you and your listeners in the hope that you can provide some guidance and insights. Please keep my name anonymous, of course, which we have. So this is a young mother of children who is living in rural Donegal. They want to join OnlyFans because they see that as a way of empowering themselves. They must feel confident about themselves and also paying the bills. But they have their concerns, their obvious concerns that, you know, someone could find out and what would the neighbours think effectively. Would you do it? Would you advise her to do it, not to do it? Why? 086 60 25 000. 086 60 25 000. From outside the Republic, 00353 86 60 25 000. That's the WhatsApp and text. That person looking some advice, please help if you can. I understand the dilemma. In all elements of, I think they covered really what most people might be concerned about, but also what might motivate some people to go down that route. OK, we're joined in studio now by Alice Doyle, who's visiting the county, as she puts herself forward as the first female to run for the position as vice president of the IFA nationally. A very good morning to you, Alice. Thank you so much for calling up.
Good morning, Greg, and to all your listeners. Great to be with you in Donegal this morning. And nice fine morning so far.
Isn't it?
Rain is just holding off.
It's always lovely up here. You attended a meeting last night. Was it a general IFA meeting, or was it an opportunity to put forward your candidacy to local members?
It was an opportunity to visit Donegal first and meet the IFA officers, particularly in Donegal. I have met some of them before, but it was a good opportunity to meet them as a group of them last night. And I had a great welcome from them, I have to say, as always in Donegal. And we had a good opportunity to chat about all issues, really, not just election issues, because I deal with a lot of issues in IFA, and most of those are very relevant to Donegal. Things like the Fair Deal scheme, the inheritance and succession and health and well-being, all of those come under my remit as chair of the Farm, Family and Social Affairs Committee. So we had a good discussion about all of those issues as well. So it was a broad discussion about many issues, and particularly in my position as chair of the Farm, Family Committee. And yes, of course, I am running for Deputy President of IFA and the first woman to do that, to do that in its 68-year history. So of course that came up for discussion and was part of our discussion last night.
Yeah, but you have a good starting point in that you'd be familiar to listeners of this programme and others, and also to farmers through your work as chair of the National IFA Farm, Family and Social Affairs Committee. So you have a bit of a head start. Not a head start, but you've...
Well, yes, I would be known, I suppose, yes. And I have visited Donegal in that capacity before as well, back about a year ago. I think I spoke to you even here on radio when I was up visiting for the farm safety and health project we had up here. Donegal ran a very good open evening out on Porter's Farm, and it was a terrific evening, great, very well attended, a lot of very good discussion around all those health and safety, particularly farm safety issues. So I have to say, I would be well known through that. I would be well known throughout the country in that I promote all these issues, because I believe IFA should be promoting these particular issues, the area of, particularly as I said, about inheritance and succession, the farm safety and the Fair Deal scheme, which is something that IFA worked very hard to get. And I know in all counties, and also here in Donegal, that was greatly appreciated when we got the 3-year cap for farmers on that. And part of my job is to make sure that farmers are aware that is available to them, and if they need help in applying for the scheme or whatever, that they do come to their local IFA office, who usually put them in contact with me or one of my members of my committee who will deal with it. So we work very hard towards that, and that would be my aim. Again, if I go forward, as I put myself forward in this position, I think it's because I am used to putting information out there to farmers, listening to what their needs are and responding to the needs, whether, as I said, it was any of those issues that I have mentioned. They are the main issues that were being raised by farmers in certain areas.
Yep.
And we took those on board, and we're now providing the information to them around that, and to make farmers aware of the fact that, IFA are a very strong body that way, that not only do we advocate for farmers, we negotiate on their behalf, but we also provide a lot of help and information, and not to be afraid to come forward to look for that.
Yeah, you mentioned that you're putting yourself forward as the first female to run for the position as Vice President of the IFA nationally. What's the significance of your gender in this campaign?
I think it's quite significant in a way. Like, females have always been involved in farming. They're actually almost, I suppose you could say, half of farming in an unregistered way, in that they're the partner on a farm, like I am a partner with my husband on the farm. Many of them work off farm and contribute to the farm through their income. So they to have those recognised. And women have always been involved in IFA at local level. It's only now that we're coming to national level, and that's because of change of circumstances for people. We've had people always at local level, but we've had people at county level. We've had some very good female county chairs who served at national council as well. There is another female who is a national chair of the Farm Business Committee. But I think I'm the first one who has, I don't know whether you would say courage or inclination or encouragement, being given the encouragement to go forward to run for the position. And I think it's timely, because in every organisation, balance is needed. And I do think the female brings a balance into it. When we have male and female working together, we get a better outcome, I think. And I think that I will bring that, if I was given the opportunity by the members and I'm elected as Deputy President, I would bring that balance to it. And I would bring a skill set, I suppose, that others may not have.
And presumably you may bring women to the ballot box who perhaps don't ordinarily vote. There could be quite a significant female vote here if they see you as the person they want in this position.
Absolutely. I would hope that both genders will vote for me.
Of course,
but I do agree with you. I think in the past we would have seen a lot of members are female. They don't necessarily come out to meetings and cast their vote where you had to come out to a meeting and cast your vote. This year, because the voting is by ballot, a postal ballot, I think that's going to help as well. It's going to give the females an opportunity who may not, maybe because of child commitment at home or work commitments or whatever, cannot get out to a meeting, can now put their ballot in the post. And I think that will help me. Of course it will. And
yeah,
I think they will see me.
To some extent, there's probably an element of kind of quasi-pairing that goes on as well, you know, because they probably have the other half that's voting and... You know what I mean?
Very true.
So how many IFA members take part in this vote?
There's about 73,000 members
really
throughout the country.
Isn't it?
All the way from Mallon to Mizzen and from Galway across to Dublin. So it's a lot of members. And, you know, the organisation is a very big organisation. It's a very diverse, when I say diverse, I mean in the sense of different commodities. There's all the different commodities. So we're representing all commodities from all parts of the country, all kinds of backgrounds. We have a lot of mostly full-time farmers, but a lot of part-time farmers now. And I very much represent all of that because I work in partnership with my husband, but also worked off farm.
Yeah. Do you have any concerns about the position of the IFA at the moment in that, you know, you certainly might hear up here a lot of conversation about how they're, you know, they're in it for the big guys, that, you know, they're government mouthpieces at times. They're not interested in, you know, the small rural farm, the small family farm. I'm not saying all of that is true, but that's the type of criticism that you might hear. You can very easily lose that connection with people on the ground if you're not careful. Do you have any concerns about the direction, or maybe do you feel there needs to be a change in tact from the IFA? Do you recognise some of those criticisms that I've outlined to you there?
I can see why there could be certain criticisms. I mean, every organisation will be criticised at certain times, no matter what your organisation is. And particularly when you represent, as I said, a very diverse group of commodities, you're always going to have that, because at any one time, one commodity will seem to be more dominant in the organisation than the other because there's a crisis in that particular commodity. So, you know, the others will feel a little bit left out, but you would hope that the turn of each one will come. And I think IFA do that. And it isn't always obvious, because a lot of what we do is done behind the scenes, and a lot of work isn't public. We don't necessarily go out and blow our own trumpet and say all the time what we're doing for everybody. So people can sometimes not be aware of the fact that we are actually working very hard for everybody. It might appear that because that's the one that gets the headlines all the time. I certainly do believe we have a good body of work to do in relating to the public in general, because, you know, in the past, everybody in Ireland were very closely related to a farming background. There were never any more than one generation removed from a farming background. That has changed dramatically because of the reducing number of farmers, for starters, but also the fact that more people are moving away from rural Ireland, they're moving into the towns and cities. So they become more removed from the rural organisations. And because that has happened, I think we need, as a farming organisation, to relate better in future, or to make just communicate, I think, more with the non-farming community.
Do you have concerns about the commitment from this government to farming in this country? Because again, there are many feel that, you know, it's very easy to blame farmers for climate change. You know, it's easy because, you know, a lot of townies will go, yeah, of course it must be them, and I can hold on to my petrol and diesel car, and I'll continue to wash out my tomato sauce out of my glass jar and I feel I'm doing something. Then we see these deals like the Brazilian beef deal, and we're seeing, you know, Eastern European beef and other products landing on our shelves here, and it's getting harder and harder and harder to make a living. Is there another generation of farming in this country? Like, do you believe that, do you have any concerns, put it to you like this, that farmers on the scale that we have now are being or will be legislated out of business? For all the wrong reasons, because we will be transporting produce great distances, we'll be importing it, for all those reasons. Do you have any concerns about farmers being legislated out of business?
It's a very good comment, and I think a lot of farmers do worry about that, and it is a real concern. I mean, legislation has become very tight. It has become very intrusive in the sense that it's impacting on everybody at this stage, farming and non-farming, but particularly in the farming community. The legislation is very, very imposing, and I think what has happened with the legislation, whereas legislation is required to a certain extent, we understand that. We're not afraid to accept legislation, but I think it has to be informed legislation, and legislation that is informed by how the farming, how farming works. Farming is somewhat different in that it's open to many different elements that change on a regular basis. We only look out the window this morning and weather is a huge impacting factor. And if you legislate that, you know, certain things can only be done in a certain closed period for farming, and the weather doesn't allow you to do that, then that's a serious regulation that has been put in there, and it's going to impact seriously on the farmer. So I think we will accept legislation, but it has to be legislation that is informed. And I think that's part of the job of our organisation, to inform government, to in turn inform the European Parliament, because most of it is coming from Europe. And we have to now realise that we're not just dealing with our own local government. We're dealing very much with European legislation, and that's impacting very much on us. And we have legislators in different, you know, in a different environment, legislating for a community, for a type of industry that they're not familiar with. So they're bringing in regulation that is so tight that doesn't give way any room at all for wriggle room in there, in order for things like the weather, for change of Europe, for markets. You have, like, all the things, like, you have international markets, you have the war in Ukraine, like, and a war in any part of the country. If you have a drought in America, that could change the whole cereal, you know, the
butterfly effect
cereals
almost,
here.
But it's
so
much
you have
bigger
that,
than a
butterfly. You have all these factors which can impact on farmers. And we as an organisation have to do our very best to try and bring forward policy that will inform our national government, mm-hmm. and in turn the European government. And to make sure that any regulation that comes in,
yes,
we're
but we
not
have to make sure. But we have to make sure on a European level that we aren't picking out what industries different countries have in. In other words, is Ireland trees, solar panels, and data centres, and Poland is beef?
That's very true. We have to be very careful about that.
Do you know where I'm coming from?
Yes, I do.
So in other words, it's not really. It's not that these legislations and rules are affecting countries equally.
Exactly. And we are an agricultural producing country. We produce food. That's what we're good at. And as you mentioned earlier, you know, taking in beef from third world, from other countries, for say Argentina, where it's produced not in as good an environmental conditions as we can do it here, that seems totally illogical. We can do the job here, and accept that we can do the job very well here. We can produce world-class food in world-class conditions from a climate point of view. And that should be recognised. And it has to be recognised that that's our strength, and that we must be given the opportunity to do that. Because if not, we're talking the two sides of our mouth. We're talking about saving the world, you know, from a climate point of view. And then we're going to regulate people out of producing food in a very good environmental conditions.
When you see this is the whole, and we could get into a whole broader conversation about bringing people along this sort of save the world conversation. It has to make sense. You know, it has to make sense. Obviously, you're in the region from where the agriculture minister comes from, and you're sourcing votes from the same pool that he is. Are you satisfied with how he's working for the farming community?
Look, at all times we support the Minister for Agriculture in what he does. We will also differ with him on many occasions about how things are being done and how his department are running things. And yes, we've had a lot of good things have come from Mr. McConlogue. He has done a lot of good work for farmers. We can always say too that we've had our differences with him. He has always listened to us. Whether, you know, as my mother used to say, you can hear people, you may not heed them. I know he always hears us. I'm not so sure that his department always heeds us. But having said that, you know, I know his heart is in the right place. He would be doing his very best. It isn't always within his hands and within his means to do it. His hands can be tied sometimes as well by higher powers that don't allow things to happen. But certainly, he's always been open to engagement. And I think we have to accept that. That's very important, that a minister would be open to engagement.
And finally, pardon my ignorance, or maybe it's not. I seem to have in the back of my head, if you are successful in election as vice president, does that mean at some point you go on to become president?
No. It doesn't. No, it's not a given.
Right.
And my focus very much would be that if I got elected, this is a 4-year task, and if I can give my best 4 years to that, I would be only focusing very much. My goal is to do a good job in that 4 years, and whatever comes after. But certainly, my eye is not on the next target. My eye is on this target and on this goal, and to make this a success.
All right, Alice. Thanks for calling in. It's been nice to have you in the studio. That's Alice Doyle. Ballots will be going out to IFA members. And That's in November, isn't
it? 1st of November.
1st of November.
The ballot papers will be arriving in people's houses, and they have until the 8th of December to return them. And they can either return them by post or they can take them to their local branch AGM and return it that way. So they have a number of opportunities this year to actually return their ballots. And we'd encourage people to use their ballot, particularly people who haven't come out before, to do that. And can I take this opportunity to thank you for having me and to wish all your listeners safe farming and healthy farming, healthy and safe, and all your listeners in general. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Alice. That's Alice Doyle there. OK, you're welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Now, I had a contact earlier on or overnight from a listener who is a young mum and was considering joining OnlyFans. Some of you texting in, not necessarily in support of it. A young mother joining OnlyFans, that's a real good example to set for your children and society in general. Why not better yourself and your prospects by doing an online course to improve your chances of a better job instead of that nonsense, they say. A lot of money in it, though. That OnlyFans text typifies the attitude of today's youth. Sell your soul to make a quick buck. What happened to hard work, decency and modesty? Terrible decision to do that. Anything online is, they say, online forever. And you can keep your calls and comments coming in on that. A caller says this country, or should I say this government and the electricity companies, don't give a damn about these people who are saving this country millions by taking care of their own at home. It's all about money. It's true saying the rich get richer and the poor don't get poorer, but now they tramp on them. Why the hell are the people of this country putting up with all this crap from this government and companies? Well, what do you expect people to do? That being said, it is the case that after the last budget, the rich did get somewhat richer, or at least somewhat better off, and the poor pretty much stayed where they were, or at least the gap between the two widened, is what a recent report has shown. Diesel and petrol has taken a big jump this week again. What's the reason this time and why is no one talking about it? Well, you are, and you're opening the conversation. That's what we're all about here. And the prices vary greatly all over the place. It really is remarkable how the prices can vary from one area to another. OK, we've got still loads to come on the show. As you can imagine, it is the 9 till noon show. We're going to take a break now for the news and the obituary notices, but stay right where you are. We'll be back with much more in just a few moments.